In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne high and lofty, and the hem of his robe filled the temple. Seraphs were in attendance above him. Each had six wings. With two, they covered their faces. With two, they covered their feet. And with two, they flew. And one called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of God's glory." The pivots on the thresholds shook at the voices of those who called, and the house filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe is me, I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. Yet my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Then one of the seraphs flew to me, holding a live coal that had been taken from the altar with a pair of tongs. The seraph touched my mouth with it and said, "Now that this has touched your lips, your guilt has departed and your sin is blotted out." Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send and who will go for us?" And I said, "Here am I, send me." The word of the Lord. You know this song. "Here I am, Lord, is it I, Lord? I have heard you calling in the night." We sang those words just last week as new elders and deacons began their terms of service. It's a favorite hymn, to be sure. The Catholics gave it to us. We're not going to give it back. We like it too much. And whenever we sing it around here, it is certain to give a positive response. The tune is singable. The words are heartfelt. If you looked around last week, you probably saw somebody somewhere wiping a tear or two. "Here I am." Now, when you heard today's scripture text, you probably noticed that some of the words of the song are lifted right out of that text. Isaiah of Jerusalem remembers the voice of God calling him to his life's work. God is looking for the right person to speak up, the right person to speak out, the right person to address the people of Judah in troubling times. Who's it going to be? Who will speak up for God? And Isaiah declares, "Here I am, Lord." Now, for most of us, that's kind of where it all stops. That's all of us, what we know about the prophet Isaiah for the most part. He's the one who responds affirmatively to God's voice. And of course, that's the punchline to the story. And it's like a lot of those other stories of God speaking to Moses out of a burning bush. "Go to Pharaoh, tell him to let my people go." Or Jesus walking along the shore of the Sea of Galilee, calling out to some fishermen, "Come follow me, I will make you fish for people." It's that kind of story. The plot of each one goes the same way. God says, "I need to get something done." And the heroic Bible character says, "Okay, I will do it." The rest of us cheer from the sidelines, breathe a sigh of relief, and figure, mission accomplished. What's the text for next week? Somebody out there is doing what God needs to get done. In other words, it's not really a story for the rest of us. It's about some specialist who says yes to the Lord. In this case, a long, long time ago. And if you hear a bunch of ministers gather together, sometimes they'll even speak about how that occasion came to them and will think, well, that's where they believe. That's where they belong. Up on some dusty shelf. But if you were listening to the story, you heard a lot more going on. It's true, the conclusion is the ancient prophet declares, "Okay, God, sign me up," but that's just a conclusion. and a provisional conclusion at that. This story is the kind of story that becomes a lot more interesting the more we dig in. So here are three things I'd like you to notice. The seraphs, the unclean lips, the burning coal. First, the seraph. On Thursday morning, one of our office volunteers was proofreading your worship bulletin before it was printed. I walked through to grab a donut. She looked up and she said, "What's a seraph?" I said, "What? A seraph? The Bible passage says three times there are seraphs. What are they?" I said, "I don't know. I don't think I've ever met one. But they're kind of a super angel." She looked at me with a most curious glance. And then I said, as I took another bite out of the donut, "The bigger question is, what are they doing in that temple?" And she looked really confused. So I gave my little talk. The seraphs, or as they're sometimes called, the seraphim, are only mentioned here as angelic beings. Elsewhere, they are fiery snakes. These seraphs have three pairs of wings to fly, to cover themselves in modesty, and to cover their faces in reverence. There are texts outside of the Bible that speak about different orders of angels, but the Bible doesn't expend a lot of energy on that one. Suffice it to say, the seraphim are the ones closest to God, which satisfied our Thursday volunteer, but then I pressed the other question. So what are they doing in the temple? I took another bite from the donut, and I said, "That's a trick question, because it has to do with King Uzziah, who's mentioned in the very first verse and then quickly dismissed." So let me tell you all what I told her. King Uzziah began as a wonderful king. Given the sorry list of all Israel's terrible kings, he was pretty good. He ruled for 52 years. He chased out the Philistines. He defended the borders. He built up the economy. In the words of the Bible's greatest compliment, he learned the fear of the Lord. That is, until he got a little too big for his britches. Uzziah believed that since he was the king and things were going well, that he should then also act as if he's a priest. So one day he grabs the incense pot, starts smoking up a little frankincense, heads into the temple toward the high altar, and this is a really bad move. The Bible calls it, 2 Chronicles, a desecration, an abomination. In our speech, a really bad move. Uzziah is stopped in his tracks by the high priests and 80 other priests, all described as men of valor. An argument breaks out. Uzziah figures, "Well, I'm the king, and kings can do whatever they want." And the priest said, "Oh, no, no, no." And just when Uzziah was getting really huffy, leprosy broke out all over his face. So they hustled him out of the temple, somehow not touching him. The temple now is doubly desecrated. And this guy, the king, is going to have to live in seclusion. He can still call himself the king, but nobody's ever going to go near him or pay any further attention to him. And in fact, his son is going to have to run the country. He had leprosy until the day he died. And the Bible's moralists say, that's what you get when you're too big for your britches in the temple. Meanwhile, the temple is still desecrated. And in the year Uzziah died, God shows up. It was big. It was really big. Even the seraphim were there. Nobody had ever seen one, I figure. But Isaiah knew what a seraph was when he saw one. Their voices were thunderous. "Holy, holy, holy. The foundations are shaking. The house is filled with smoke." And I took another bite from my donut. You may wonder why it's hard for us to get volunteers in the office. And I asked again, so what are the seraphim doing there in a desecrated temple? They are announcing the holiness of God is even there, especially there. They are announcing in 2800-year-old language, there is no distinction between sacred and secular because God is there, so it's sacred. Now let that sink in. That whenever God is present, it is holy, holy, holy. Wherever. The implications are staggering. Someone describes it this way. One of the bad habits we pick up early in our lives is separating things and people into secular and sacred. We assume the secular is what we are more or less in charge of, our jobs, our entertainment, our government, our social relations. The sacred is what God is in charge of, worship and the Bible, heaven and hell, church and prayers. We then contrive to set aside a sacred place of God, designed, we say, to honor God, but really intended to keep God in his place, leaving us free to have the final say about everything else that goes on. Prophets like Isaiah will have none of this. They contend that everything, absolutely everything, takes place on holy ground. God has something to say about every aspect of our lives, the way we feel and act in the so-called privacy of our homes, the way we make our money, the way we spend our money, the politics we embrace, the ways we fight, the catastrophes we endure, the people we hurt, and the people we help. Nothing is hidden from the scrutiny of God. Nothing is exempt from the rule of God. Nothing escapes the purposes of God. Holy, holy, holy. So, second, Isaiah says, woe is me, I have unclean lips. I live among a people of unclean lips. In the presence of a holy God, the only God there is, we are toast. Now that's my translation. What he's missing, of course, is the very thing that he sees, that the seraphs are in the same room with him, the same filthy room, and that God is there too, a pure, holy God in the midst of that desecrated temple. His first only response is, there isn't room here for the likes of me and the likes of us. We are people of unclean lips. Now that again is an interesting Bible phrase, appearing only here in the whole biblical text. Even though it's an ancient phrase, you can probably surmise what it means. It has something to do with lips, but it reveals something else. So I'm sitting there in my sermon writing chair, catching up on emails and doing everything I can to possibly figure out how do I talk about unclean lips, and then I see a news item. There's a retired high school English teacher who wrote a letter to the president recently about gun violence in the schools. She received a form letter back from the White House, retired English teacher. She said the grammar was atrocious. There were redundancies, incorrect capitalizations, lack of clarity, lack of reasoning. So, as was her habit, she corrected the letter in purple ink and sent it back. USA Today reported the story. It was a slow news day. And you might not think that a retired teacher correcting a letter written at a fourth grade level would be a big deal. But most curious was reading the online comments and criticisms of what she did. They're a mile long. incorrect capitalizations, redundancies, lack of clarity in reasoning, and just downright mean. Her critics take issue with her and call her stupid. And then they start calling one another stupid. And then it descends into hell from there. And suddenly I think I understood what it means. Alas, we are a people of unclean lips. Unclean lips reveal a filthy heart. That's the sense of the biblical phrase. In fact, in one of the Psalms, there's a complaint lodged against a person with dirty heart and lips. Your tongue is like a sharp razor, you worker of treachery. You love evil more than good and lying more than speaking the truth. You love all words that devour, O deceitful tongue. In the presence of a holy God, what does Isaiah know? He is surrounded by people of impure speech, destructive insults, lying impulses, and forked tongues, and he counts himself among them. Third, that brings us to the burning coal, the great nevertheless. The Bible repeatedly offers God's great nevertheless. So God is announced in the temple by the seraphim. He discovers he is on holy ground. Isaiah knows he and the people are broken and unworthy, and God decides to bridge the gap. In a most symbolic act, one of the seraphs flies to the altar of the temple, picks up a burning coal, and comes to touch the unclean lips of the prophet. And then the pronouncement is given. Your guilt is chased away. Your sin is over and done. The God who is already present in the desecrated temple is now able to reach all the desecrated people. There is mercy and there is forgiveness for all who can accept it. And if you accept it, there is work for you to do. It's a terrific text. It's a huge story. And it brings to mind the recurring conversation I have with folks here, folks in town. Maybe I'm over in line at the ice cream store, bump into somebody I haven't seen. They apologize they haven't been in worship. There'll be a lot of them tomorrow. They'll see me in line offering Rocky Road and how they're not in this room. And these days I smile, I tell them it's good to see them. That's what you say. You don't say we've been missing you. That lays on the guilt. No, you say it's good to see you. How are you doing? And if the conversation opens up, I might even ask, so where is holy ground for you? And I'll just listen. How would you answer that question? Where is holy ground? The Bible answers this way. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. The psalmist continues, where can I flee your presence, O Lord? Wherever I go, you are already there. And the conclusion is that all ground is holy ground, and our life's work is with contending with, living with, the God who is already here. It'll be a journey. God comes in clarity and judgment when an out-of-touch king thinks he's something more than he is. God comes as pure and perfect light, revealing all of our cracks and imperfections in that light of great mercy. God steps through and beyond the distance that separates us from his holiness declaring again and again, we are forgiven and free. And then God gives us something to do. There's always something to do. Because holiness is not something to be bottled like perfume that we spritz a little bit here and there. Holiness is something to be lived out in the world as much as the temple. Holiness is the clear and abiding sense that God is here with us, among us, and that we are part of God's purposes for the world. So enjoy this Sabbath as a gift. Enjoy this weekend as a gift. If the rain stops and the parade happens, come down to the end of the block and join us on Presbyterian Corner tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Do something with the people you love this weekend. Do something that restores life to your soul and gives life to the people around you. But for God's sake, for God's holy sake, bring some glory to the God who is here, remembering always that the ground beneath our feet is holy ground.